Hey listeners, before I get into this episode, I have a quick ask to make. I started this podcast as a research project on how to be a top individual contributor in the product design space. My goal for the show was to learn what it takes to be an individual contributor that is doing amazing, impactful work that they love doing day in and day out and getting paid top dollar while they do it. Becoming that type of individual contributor is the ultimate job security. With close to 100 hours of interview recordings, this has naturally led to the creation of the short-form video articles that synthesize my learnings into 10-minute listens of actionable content. You might recognize these as my morning walk episodes or the hashtag shorts episodes. To my surprise, those episodes have been very well received and listeners have enjoyed the synthesis of what I've learned. This has led to the next chapter of my research project, which is beginning to synthesize what I've learned into a new newsletter called Thinking Out Loud About Design that you can subscribe to right now for free. Thinking Out Loud About Design is an email newsletter and podcast that basically contains all my synthesis for my long-form interviews. It's pure distilled learnings that you can apply to your career immediately. This content is for you if you are a couple years into your career and you're trying to make that move from mid-level to senior designer and senior designer to staff designer. I mainly focus on becoming high-performing individual contributors in the product design industry. A free subscription gives you full access to the newsletter, podcast episodes, and website. You won't have to worry about missing anything because every new edition of the newsletter goes directly into your inbox. So my ask is this. If you have gotten any value out of the way of product design, or if it's helped you in any way or someone you know, please subscribe to Thinking Out Loud About Design and get the distilled learnings on being a staff-level individual contributor. You can find a link to the newsletter in the show notes of every episode of this podcast and on my LinkedIn page. Just look up Caden Damiano. Thanks again for listening and supporting the way of product design. I wouldn't be doing this if you guys weren't listening. Now, on to the show. Welcome to the Way of Product Design. I'm your host, Caden Damiano. This podcast has one mission: help product designers generate massive value for their clients, their companies, and themselves so they can do the work they enjoy the most. We know design is valuable, but how can you unlock the true value of design in your work? To help with this, I interview top performers in design, product management, and engineering so you can understand what's valuable to your stakeholders, your bosses, and your customers. So enjoy this episode. Thanks for listening.
Hey, I'm Cam Sackett.
And I'm Caden Damiano. Welcome to Pivot, a podcast to learn about how designers solve problems.
You'll hear from industry leaders about their beginning stories, when and how they pivoted into design, and what we can do to be better human-centered designers.
In this episode, we talk about conversation design. What is it? How to get into it, how to design for voice interfaces, and how it will make us better communicators and overall better designers. We have the privilege of learning from Margaret Urban and Michael Greenberg, two interaction designers at Google. Also, just to note, we apologize for the poor audio quality in this episode. And probably all of our episodes. A lot of these conversations are recorded over the phone. And honestly, we don't have a lot of control when doing it that way. You know, sometimes there's bad internet or poor cell service or just a whole slew of things that go on in the background. So we do apologize for the poor audio quality. Nevertheless, the content and the people that we interview is what we care about the most, and sharing those insights and conversations with the community. So despite all the choppiness, we still hope you enjoy and benefit from what we have to share.
Okay, does that work?
Yeah, that sounds better.
Yay!
Okay, cool. All right, we did it. Cool, set up. It's always just a technical trouble with every remote interview, but hopefully this should work pretty well.
Cool. Agreed.
So, Margaret, Michael, welcome to the Pivot Podcast.
Thank you. I guess let's just get started since we've never done two guests at the same time before, and we have an hour of recording time. So let's just jump into it. Just starting with Margaret, how about you talk about your background and just how did you end up in conversational design? Because that's not, there's no direct path right now.
Yeah, it's really something that didn't exist as a discipline for lots of years, so it's pretty new. When I was reading the question that said, like, when you decided to pivot into design, I was thinking, you know, I've kind of been in various aspects of user experience my whole working life. So I used to work as an editor in a publishing house, and my goal at the time was to create books that people could access the content in without having any challenges through the format. So making the format as transparent as possible. And then I got excited about language, and I went back to grad school for linguistics. Partly I said, I was thinking, I'm the youngest of four children, and I think of this as a little bit of a pop psych analysis, but I was always trying to figure out like the undercurrents of communication, dynamics of my family, and smooth that. So my kind of goal has always been to smooth interactions across, you know, groups or people or whatever it's going to be. And because we were all languagey, like wordy nerds, that's the domain I went into. So then I was in grad school, and a friend of mine said, hey, you got to check out this company named Nuance Communications. And I'd been looking at how people use language and how people use meaning in the real world in basically text corpora. But then when I went into Nuance and we were talking about speech recognitions and designing for actual conversations, that was really exciting to me. And so I've been doing that ever since, which is actually 18 years now.
Nice.
Yeah, Nuance Communications, that's a pretty on-the-nose name.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Nuances and communications.
Yes, yeah.
Cool. All right, Michael?
So I, unlike Margaret, have not been in the UX space for a very long time, but that's okay. So I actually got brought in, I pivoted into conversation design through Margaret, so it's interesting that we're both sitting here talking to you. So I got a degree in linguistics and had no idea what I wanted to do. I didn't know that I wanted to go into design, but similar to Margaret, I've kind of always looked at why things are the way that they are and how they function, and someone had to have designed it. It hadn't really occurred to me that someone had put in effort designing it, but I understood that everything was the way it was for some reason or another. Mm-hmm. So I studied linguistics. I came to Google as a contractor and worked on a team working on the Google Assistant where we were building the voices. And that was cool, but it wasn't quite challenging enough for me. So I met Margaret through a mutual friend, ironically not a Google mutual friend, and had lunch, and we talked about what it means to do design and what conversation design is and what voice design is. And that really kind of piqued my curiosity and sparked this moment where I was like, wow, you can design conversation in such a way that you can create a really wonderful experience with it. So that was my pivot, is Margaret, I guess. That was my pivot.
Yeah.
So that's why you're invited on, probably. Which is super awesome. You guys have provided so much value so far. I was very impressed that I reached out and you're like, oh, well, I'm just going to take, since we're Google, we have like a dedicated person to set these things up. Oh, and by the way, let's bring Margaret on. She has like way over a decade of experience in the industry. Yeah. So you could both like talk to those people. And you guys have been so far.
We have really interesting different perspectives to offer. Margaret has kind of been in this space for a really long time and is an expert. And I'm essentially still a fresh college graduate. So not really knowing about the space and falling into it, whereas Margaret kind of helped define the space.
Well, that's very kind of you. But I'll also say one of the links between Michael and myself is the fact that we both were at Berkeley's linguistics department, which had a focus on cognitive linguistics, which is very much how language in the mind, how language works, and how people use it and express in the real world. And I think that's one of the things that probably drew you in this direction as well.
Absolutely. Really what Margaret and I studied, albeit at different times.
90s.
2010s. What we studied really was like, yeah, how is meaning represented cognitively, and then how is language the vehicle for meaning? And that sounds pretty basic. Like, of course, language is how you convey meaning, but really what Margaret and I focused on is how is it being conveyed in language? Why do we choose some words over other words? And how are these things structured? There are structures in meaning, and how are they surfaced through language to people? And kind of that's at the root of a lot of miscommunication, is at the root of a lot of misunderstanding between people when you're having conversations. So this kind of discourse analysis, cognitive linguistics, frame semantic approach to the problem, I think is what...
all about conversation
design. It's all about conversation.
Yeah, and I think that like voice interfaces are really like the key to reduce like that friction with computers and devices and stuff. I mean, just the other day, I love my Kindle Fire like TV stick. I just need to say like, yeah, play Community, and it's just one step and it's done. And I think this is just such an important field, and more people should get into it. And I really want that to be the focus of this interview, is just really talking about, like, there's not a lot of traditional options right now. I mean, like, Cam and I were lucky. We were able to study it in school. But, yeah, like, what skills do you need to develop? And then maybe a little bit about, like, the nuances of linguistics. Because it's very complex, and it's such a natural thing. People are like, I know how to talk. I could design for voice. But how does Google go about designing something that's like rooted in our human nature? Like, you don't teach someone how to talk when you're designing conversations, like conversational interfaces. Like, you're using like the mental models we've already created as humans, right?
Yeah, that's the exact right approach. We try and lean into how people communicate in their daily lives already. That is where we start, and it's oftentimes where we end in the design process, is how are people solving this problem already today? There's a balance between inventing new technologies and capitalizing on existing technologies. And speech is not a new technology. We've been doing it since we were born. So, and
for 150,000 years.
And for 150,000 years, our physiology is kind of designed for us to be speaking. So what we often think when we're thinking through the problem is, how would somebody in real life respond to what you're saying, if you're asking, how should I design this part of the conversation? So if somebody says, hey, what's the weather today? You might want to, no, that's a bad example. If you say, hey, pass me that thing over there, you're like, which thing?
Right.
It's okay for a digital assistant to say, what exactly are you talking about? It's okay for the assistant to come back at you with a question or ask you to be more specific. And there's a conversational way to do that. And oftentimes you find the answer in how a human would do that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Like you're saying, this is a built-in system, right? We have been speaking and understanding language. One of the things I love is that babies can recognize their parents' voices when they're still in utero, right? You'll see if you play a recording of the mother's voice, even if they're not getting the physical experience of hearing the vibrations, et cetera, babies' heart rates will slow down. They'll show physiological effects of calming because they know their parents' voices, they know their mother's voices, and they even know their dad's voices. Even though they're not being carried around by them all the time. So this is happening from before we're born, right? We are being completely inculcated with this very complicated system, which has been evolutionarily derived for survival. But communication is survival. And once we recognize that that system is super complex, like you start looking under the hood, the metaphor I use for this all the time is the fish does not think about the water. That's, we talk all the time.
Margaret's famous quote.
Yeah, I know. Oh. I should really, like, I really need to come up with something new.
It's so apt, though.
I know. It's perfect. I love my metaphors. But once you recognize that it's really complex, you look under the hood and you realize that it's also highly, highly systematic. And you can make use of that systematicity in doing good design, right? Knowing what the patterns and behaviors in conversation are, you can reconstruct them to have conversations with a digital assistant, with a human.
When you really start thinking about how you communicate with other people, different people communicate with each other in different ways. There's that friend of yours who's really verbose, and there's that person who doesn't like to say very much. And both of those are completely acceptable and natural ways to communicate. So when you're thinking about how do you create a conversation with an interlocutor with a person. In this case, in our case, it's the digital assistant, the Google Assistant. You want to create a personality for that assistant to speak through and for you to learn how you can expect this assistant to communicate with you. And it's exactly as Margaret said, there's systematicity here. There are patterns. There are things that you can expect the assistant to do for you. And then there are things where it's okay that the assistant, that you know that the assistant doesn't do that. And it's the same when you're speaking with people.
I have a question. How does Google approach tackling or getting under the hood, right? How do you guys go about solving those problems with something that's so intuitive and human like voice? And then how do you go about designing a universally likable voice assistant? Like, how do you decide that Google Assistant's going to be that personality? I mean, you're catering to so many different types of cultures, and how does Google go about determining what that personality is?
Yeah, so that's really two questions, or it's probably more like five questions. Yeah. But I'm going to compare two questions and talk first about the persona side of things. So whenever you're designing a persona, you have to think about what the demographics of your users are. And like you say, Google's pretty big. And so we have a lot of different users. So that's why the assistant takes a role that people are familiar with in society, right? So there's a kind of metaphor for the assistant that everybody understands, whether they're like millionaires on Wall Street or, you know,
my grandmother.
Your grandmother. Yes. Goodness knows my mother. And so that metaphor becomes the handle by which people understand and communicate with the assistant. And then when you think about it, the assistant, when the assistant has a role to play that is assistive, like being helpful and doing things for you, it's a little bit less like trying to find find somebody that you want to hang out in a bar with, and a little bit more like finding somebody who's going to be the perfect assistant for you. So there's a way that we design the persona to think about how it's going to appeal to a lot of different people. And there's still going to be people out there who are like, I don't like this one. So maybe they choose the male voice expression of it as opposed to the female voice of it. Or maybe they choose to have the Australian voice or the English voice, right? So there's different ways that users get to optimize their experience with the assistant by choosing these different expressions of the persona within the Google Assistant. And then going back to the kind of complexity aspect of it, I mean, the way that speech recognition has always been done has been to, like, you collect a whole lot of acoustic data, you build a model, and you use that model to understand what words are being said when there's just vibrations in the air. And you can take that same methodology and apply it up the stack in terms of understanding intents, looking at conversational behaviors, looking at the way conversations pattern, and starting to build these models that can predict and respond appropriately to those natural behaviors. Now, of course, we've got us humans who are trained in this, who are building these things. So we're helping create that foundational level of understanding of conversational patterns. And that's, you know, then what we want to do is just get further and further down into the details of human conversation, which, again, super, super complex. So we don't get everything right all the time because we don't have the ability to just get to that level of detail yet.
Right.
Yet.
Right. Well,
go ahead, Cam.
I want to keep on riffing on this a little bit. You know, as designers, we have our own biases. I know you guys have your design guidelines, but your own designer biases or just human biases get driven across all kind of communication. I mean, because you're designing this voice that can actually, in a way, train and influence other people and how they communicate in the future. So I don't know. That's kind of a weird, very cohesive how I'm trying to pull this together.
I'm going to let Michael talk in a moment, but I'm just going to start by saying, like, once you start doing this, you have that Socrates moment where you realize how much you don't know.
Yeah.
And so one of the things we do know as designers, as individual designers, is that what I might design for myself might not be what would work for Michael.
Right.
So,
and this, yeah, thank you. We as designers are really aware of the fact that we're designing, but we're not our end user necessarily. There are a lot of people out there in the world, like we spoke about just a minute ago, and we're trying to design for everyone. Yeah. Right. We're trying to design for everyone. So part of our process is, yeah, we put our designs in front of loads of people and get perspectives and get critiques. And we really want to talk about, hey, this is how I've identified the solution to the problem. But
what have I missed?
What have I missed? Exactly. What did I see? What did my bias prevent me from really addressing properly? And there's an inordinate amount of iteration, as any good designer understands, that you have to iterate on your product. And I love just taking a walk down the hall, honestly, and showing people what I've come up with. And I say, hey, how would you talk about this? I just hearing perspectives from people while we're all kind of here in the office at Google. And we have that in common. We have various backgrounds, life experiences, previous jobs, education, and all of that provides really, really wonderful flavor to the story, to this dish that is the assistant that we're trying to create here. So,
not to say that we only talk to Googlers, because of course we have a massive UX research team. That's who bring what I like to call real humans.
Real humans, And there's also a huge component of that. And I have an anecdote a little bit later to talk to you about how we go out into the world and test things with people and get perspectives and try and identify if what we've identified as a solution is really what people want. Because we can kind of design from our ivory towers as much as we want, any designer can, but really you want your design to resonate with people and for them to say, this is a much more intuitive way for me to handle this problem.
Yep.
Right. So CES just happened and Google just showed off their new feature in the Google Translate product is Interpreter, right?
Yeah,
and I didn't know, it was great timing that we set up this interview, that you posted on LinkedIn that you were actually one of the leads on that team.
Yeah,
I think that would be a great case study to talk about, like, how you came up with that solution, how you went out into the world, right? Because it's multi-turn with multi-user interactions, and I'm still trying to wrap my head around just turn between the machine, the assistant, and like the user. But like, how did you go about, like, go to different cultures and everything? Yeah, just tell us the story, man.
I'd love to like walk you through some of my design process here. So, when we were thinking about the problem space of interpreters and of Translate as existing kind of as a tool for people to communicate to each other, we really wanted to capitalize on this existing model of human communication. I mean, it's kind of what we always do, but this project especially. When people are talking to each other, there's a lot of subtle nuances that we pick up on. We use context, we use gestures, we use physical presence to kind of help us do a little bit of the understanding, or a lot of the understanding, when you're having a communication with someone. So my approach was, let's treat the assistant as an interlocutor here, rather than the assistant as kind of just the thing facilitating translation between two people. Hmm. So rather than this being a conversation between two people, it's a conversation with three people. And one of those individuals, one of those interlocutors, speaks both of those languages. And that surfaces in ways in the feature, which you'll be able to try soon, about that the assistant will tell you, like, I'm not sure how to translate that, or I'm not sure I heard you correctly, or would you mind repeating that? And it's really the assistant putting itself in the conversation, because conversation is really between all of the people that are doing this communication. Usually when people use digital assistants in their smartphones, it's extremely personal. It's me and the assistant. It's me and my phone. But in this way, when you have these smart displays or smart speakers, you're both in that physical context with this device. So I wanted to make it seem like the assistant was also there present with you. And the team, we all completely agree that this was the right kind of approach to take. And hopefully it'll be that's the intuitive mental model that people are capitalizing on.
So you're still collecting data right now. You shipped it. And now you're just paying attention to it right now and seeing if
it hasn't launched quite yet. We demonstrated it at CES, but
it'll be
there.
Pulled it up on my phone.
You might have gotten a slightly different experience.
Yeah. Okay.
It's possible, but no, we haven't publicly released it yet. That'll be coming soon.
Okay. But yeah, sweet. One of the things that we love to do is find out what happens when you release something into the wild.
Yeah.
Like, there's this great Jonathan Sharia Twitter post about like what it feels like to watch a user use your thing, you know, interact with your design for the first time.
Oh yeah.
And it's this guy with a glass of water and he's totally unable to get at the water.
It is painful.
So we want to see these things. We want to learn from it. And it is, you know, it's that pain of growth. It's so good for us, right? To see what works, what doesn't work, how can we make it better?
I think as a designer, when I'm watching people use things that I've developed, that I've helped create, I'm watching with a more critical eye than I had used during the entire development process. Mm-hmm. I'm asking mm-hmm. myself, are the assumptions that I made here working? Are people struggling because of this one choice that I made? And there's, as Margaret just said, there's an element of like, once you put it out there, you kind of, it's like letting your baby go. You just got to let people use it, let people experience that pain. And as designers, the best thing we can do is kind of reflect on that and say, okay, I see how the decisions that I've made are manifesting themselves in how people are using this thing. So with interpreter mode, it's the same thing. When we were at CES watching people use it, all of those little things that maybe users didn't realize, but I was sitting there watching, like, you know, oh my gosh, it's either it's working or that didn't go so well. That's part of the test.
So, yeah, I sit there basically with a pen.
Oh my god! Right, okay, furiously scribbling down.
It is so amazingly it's so fulfilling and also just such a great learning experience to get real humans in.
Oh, yeah.
And I've seen this happen anytime we love getting users in just to get everybody on the team, all our cross-functional partners, to meet users and interact with them and talk about their needs and pain points, because then you don't have that abstraction of like user personas and end users as numbers in the system. We see them as people and we interact with them as people, and learning from them is so valuable. Yeah. And then of course, sometimes you want to go back and like kick yourself. Like, what is that?
Believe that.
How did we miss that? Whole blockbuster, well, non-blockbuster films get released that should never have been thought of in the first place. So
one anecdote I'll share about how we were trying to solve the problem of translation of interpreting was, last year especially, I spent a lot of time going around the world talking to people about how they solve their existing translation needs. And I think my favorite was a trip to India towards the middle end of last year, talking to rickshaw drivers and talking to cafe workers and just people, security guards, about how they communicate cross-culturally, how they communicate cross-linguistically, which happens a lot. There's a lot of languages in India, let me tell you. So one of my favorite anecdotes was, we were talking to this rickshaw driver, and we had said, we see you have a smartphone, do you use your smartphone? And he's like, oh, you know, well, I just got it. I was like, oh, when did you get it? And meanwhile, he's speaking Kannada, which is a dialect. We don't have somebody with us who speaks Kannada. So he has a friend who speaks Kannada in Hindi. That person was translating to Hindi through our friend, through the person who was able, and then the Hindi was coming to me in English. So did you get your smartphone? He's like, oh, I got it 10 days ago. I'm like, wow, okay. How have you communicated cross-linguistically? He's like, you know, I use my hands a lot. And I try and learn a couple of specific words. And so it's, all of these were lessons about, okay, people are really creative when they're trying to solve, especially cross-linguistic problems. So let's create an experience that kind of does some of that work for people. And I think the interpreter mode on smart displays definitely does that, where there's a lot of visual feedback about, you know, okay, I'm thinking, I'm translating, I'm waiting for you to talk now. So there's a lot of this subtle communication that happens, where previously in technology, before these kinds of things existed, that wasn't an option. We would have to struggle with either on phones, typing it in and then showing it, and then somebody else would type it in and show it.
Right. So, then, I mean, it just seems like there's such a need to learn about linguistics, you know, understand Grice's maxims, understanding what like turn taking is and like tapering and all that stuff. And I mean, anyone listening, you could just go on Google's conversational design guidelines and like learn all this. But how deep into linguistics do you have to go? Because like in the AR VR world, whenever I talk to designers, they say, well, you need to get into like 3D modeling, learn a little bit about Unity, but like to a certain point, like you just know how to like set it up for the developers. Like, how far do you have to go? Because I mean, we always have this like duality as designers, that we have to like develop skills in like a bunch of different disciplines to be good at our job. Just good, not even like great, just good at our jobs. Yeah, like how far do we go on like linguistics, like learning these principles, or does the conversational principles kind of cover it?
You want to talk about it, Margaret?
Yeah. So in the early days of voice user interface design, lots of people came from the linguistics background. But over time, we're seeing people come from like psycholinguistics and cognitive science and just human computer interaction and
sociology, human factors, and sociology. Research.
And now we're seeing people coming from like screenwriting and character development. Yeah. So there's people who come from these different domains. But I think it really goes back to the point you made about being kind of cross-functionally informed.
Yeah.
Right? You need to be able to speak the languages of the people that you're working with. So for instance, knowing something, you know, I'm not a coder, but I used to do some programming. I can write a tiny bit of this, that, and the other thing. And that means that I can speak to our engineers and understand what their needs and context are. And in the same way, we talk to usability people. I've done a little bit of usability research. I've done et cetera, et cetera. So being a generalist is a super useful thing. In terms of the language part for voice user interface design, you don't have to go and get a degree in acoustic phonetics. You don't have to like learn about formal semantics and, you know, read all the things by Chomsky and read all the things by Lakoff, et cetera, and try to formulate theories around them. But what you were talking about the discourse stuff is really key. So understanding about Grice, understanding about turn-taking, and even reading that Enfield book, How We Talk Right Now.
Yeah.
You know, I don't always love every part of that book, but it's got some really great points. Books by John McWhorter about the nature of language and how it changes. Books that there's these pop nonfiction books that are actually incredibly informative for this space, and they're very valuable. So I wouldn't say like you don't have to go and become a, you know, full on
linguist,
qua linguist, but understanding about how language works and reading about it and thinking about it. Right, the minute you start, actually, one of my other favorite metaphors is like the old story about like you ask the millipede how he walks and he immediately starts tripping over his feet because he needs to think about his feet. He doesn't know how to do it. Right. And that happens to a lot of people with language. The minute they start thinking about language, they're like, wow, I cannot ever more speak normally because I have to think about every single word. But it also gives you these insights into the nature of communication. And so you start picking up on what's going on around you and, you know, you start documenting and the next thing you know, you're writing a white paper on a particular group or something like that. So just sort of delving into it without, you know, without becoming a card-carrying linguist.
Yeah, I think getting a degree in linguistics in and of itself is not what creates a conversation designer.
Absolutely.
It's being sensitive towards language.
Absolutely.
It's thinking about what is this thing that I'm using all the time? How can I be good at this? How can I choose my words carefully and minimize misunderstanding? And how do I think about what I'm going to say before I say it? Not conceptually, but literally, quite literally linguistically, like thinking about the words themselves. Because words have meaning.
So... Yeah. When I've done a lot of resume reviews and hiring over the years, and people are always saying, so what are the key characteristics? And there's all this kind of stuff about communication, good writing, problem solving, critical thinking, abstraction of principles. But there's also this thing that I've ended up just calling a sensitivity to language, which is exactly what Michael was just talking about, which is why... When we met, I was like, okay, this man is interested and has got the right like spark that's going to bring him into this space.
Thank you, Margaret.
You're welcome. Oh.
Yeah, this is hard. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I feel the same way ever since I started learning about the Maxims. I'll like have a conversation where it just didn't go well. And then I'm just thinking, I mean, I wasn't relevant. I gave no relevant information in that conversation. Idiot.
I come back to Grice every single day of my working life, like all about relevance. It's all about quantity. It's all about, like, they're all so key.
Yeah.
And relevance actually spans beyond the word to the sentence, to the whole conversation, to even the user's journey. Like, is it relevant to bring this topic up right now? Oh, it's not. Then we'll save it for when it is.
Yeah. It's up-leveling language to what are some of the things that we can use, the components of language to understand language. And Grice is a perfect example of this. And the cooperative principle is a perfect example of this, where if you can start identifying those things in your day-to-day life, if you can, when you're writing a text message, and writing doesn't port 100% to voice, but I think it kind of speaks to that same disposition towards language. If you're thinking about how am I phrasing this, if somebody reads this, is it possible that they're going to read it in a way that I didn't intend for them to read it? Voice is very similar, especially when you're working with voice technologies where you don't have complete control over the prosody, where you can't exactly make it sound like you would say it. It's why robots sound robotic. But there is a way to make it sound more human, despite the fact that it is robotic.
Yeah. The thing I love about voice design, so I actually have a degree in linguistics as well, so I have an affinity for language and words, but
hashtag non-traditional student.
Yeah. But the thing that I loved about it, I read this book. It was I'm going to botch his name because it's French, but Ferdinand de Saussure. Yeah, about semiotics and stuff. And the thing that really interested me was just trying to convey meaning. And you touched on this in the beginning, but fast forward, when I've been studying interaction product design, and we've been studying, you know, how do you build voice interfaces, and it just kind of just brought up all these wonderful memories of language, and just like, you know what's great? I think like every designer should learn voice design, even if they don't go into that, because what it does is it opens your mind and it makes you aware of how you communicate. And that's the thing I love with voice design, is you don't have to be a voice designer, but you should at least tap into it to kind of awaken.
I mean, since I started doing voice design and conversation design here at Google, I have become much more sensitive to the words that I use
in
my life, and much more sensitive to the kinds of interactions that I'm having with people. And I know that we were going to talk about it at some point, but it's like, there are a lot of traditional interaction design patterns that we use in voice design, and they very much surface when you are in your day-to-day life and you're talking to someone and you're like, God, they flouted that maxim. They really did not, they didn't say enough. That was not enough.
It's a little bit, I read this awesome science fiction short story once about basically a society of really intelligent bats, and all their science was based on the speed of sound, whereas ours is kind of based on the speed of light. And it was this different perspective. And that's all the author really wanted to do, was like show how you can build an entire worldview around a different perspective and a different model. And that's kind of what you're saying about like getting people to like actually think about voice design, because it is a different model. We've gotten so used to training people to do things on screens, but now we have to not train them to do things with their voice, but build the right voice interaction so that they can interact naturally.
This is at the core of how we approach things here, especially, but I think in conversation design in general, which is people are used to speaking. So let's not teach them how to speak to computers. Let's teach computers how to speak like people.
Yeah.
And let's let computers kind of meet people where they are in their comfortability around speak. We should be doing the work for them, not the other way around.
Yeah, we need to do the heavy lifting.
Yeah. So Michael and I, we met at the XD Immersive Conference, and one of the big talks was saying that like AR isn't like gestural interfaces. Like, we're just creating gestures because we're teaching people how to interact with AR. But like the real interface with AR in the future would probably be voice. And it's so like there's like
more Blade Runner and a little less Minority Report.
Yeah.
Yep.
Sorry, I'm super nerdy when it comes to like, this is going to be like a tangent for one brief second, but Blade Runner, I wanted to actually say this at the beginning of the podcast, kind of a linguistic test here. If I say this, I'm hoping that you guys would hear this. If I say Maigovanen, do any of you know what I mean? What language is that? Quick test. If you can't get it in the 5 seconds, I'll tell you.
I don't know.
Because Margaret, you speak Elvish and Klingon?
Neither of those really well anymore.
Not well anymore.
It's actually Elvish for Maigovanen. But I just, the fact that you even notated that it was Elvish was good. Nice. Anyway, side tangent over.
So I have a couple questions I'm going to mix together. It's, you know, so I'm wondering how like the design teams are set up at Google. Like, is it like a normal embedded team, or is just the UX designers, but you're conversationally like focused? But the Pixel phones are very integrated into voice. Like, I think it's the only phone that you could be like, hey, take a selfie, Because when I talk to Siri, she just opens my camera. I'm like, thanks. Like,
right. That's
Google helpful. Actually like does it. Do you actually interact with like other interaction designers on your teams? Like, how's it organized? And how do you do that?
Not to talk about the specifics of the team organization, but we are always in co-design mode with interaction designers, with hardware designers, with product owners across different spaces at Google, as well as with the engineering and the kind of project managers who work on them. So it's super, super cross-functional because like the assistant is everywhere, you know, not to sound too Skynet, but because the assistant, so one of the things we know from, NASA and, is it NASA and Brave? Yeah. Wired for Space 2005 is that an inconsistent participant in conversations is somebody who is less trustworthy.
Yeah.
So we work with Google Assistant to be consistent across surfaces and across interaction types. And this is not saying that it's like slavishly saying exactly the same thing all the time, not repetitive, humanly consistent in its conversational interactions. So to do that, we have to be interacting with the people who are doing the phones and the people who are doing the televisions and the people who are doing the smart speakers and the displays and the home hub so that we have a consistent persona represented, just being expressed on different surfaces and with different access to modalities.
There are a bunch of different ways to communicate that the assistant can communicate to users. It can be graphically, it can be through voice, and it's all kind of part of the same metaphor. So it's really important that we are constantly working with visual designers, product designers, hardware designers, so that we can make sure that the metaphor of the assistant is consistent across all of these places that it exists. So yeah, we spend a lot of time with engineers, both embedded, but also with other designers embedded. So we're really all over the place because what makes
we're
it
everywhere.
We're everywhere.
Do you even have a desk, or do you even sit at your desk?
Yeah, we have desks. Yeah. Desks are, you can come back to them after you've been at meetings.
That's true. So certainly I have multiple desks. Some of them
really
One of the engineering teams that I work with, because it's really important for designers, especially at scale at really large companies. The thing that you're working on is going to touch so many hands, and a lot of different perspectives will be given around what you're working on. So it's important for you to be able to be in sync with the team that's building this thing. And also, it's really important to be able to develop the ability to speak about your designs kind of at a higher level.
Yes.
The reason that you've designed something in some such way, the reason that you made this decision, and having really good relationships with other designers that you're either working on the project with, engineers, products, that's going to serve you very well.
You just reminded me, this is a slight back pointing to the kind of skill set. So there's folk who have the sensitivity to language, and like, for instance, people who are screenwriters, they know this, they've been writing dialogue, but they don't always have the ability yet to articulate why they chose a particular thing and that it is principled and systematic underlyingly. So that's one of the reasons to learn about discourse and conversation structure, is to be able to articulate your design decisions in those ways.
Right.
And so as Michael is saying, we need to be able to tell people why we've done something in a particular way, because you know, at Google, as every place, you need to be able to back up your decision with principles and with data.
There's that expression, broken clock is right twice a day.
Mm-hmm.
When you're designing, you don't want to be right because you happen to get it right. You want to know that your design is a good design because you've approached it in a really principled way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And by working with people cross-functionally, other designers, not just showing them your design, but truly working with them, having a really collaborative relationship and co-designing projects, that's very important. And we do that all the time here.
Awesome. So I do have one last question that I'd like to, and this is the one I was kind of hinting to that I didn't formulate very well at the beginning, but so, you know, language shapes thoughts and can influence people's behaviors. How do you go about balancing ethical aspects in conversation design?
Yeah, so I mean, we've all seen Arrival, right? Where the nature of the language of the aliens that came to the planet means that they are able to move through time in a more fluid way than we can. So that's a bit extreme. And the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis is not necessarily held to be, you know, the ground truth of all things. So language and culture have an interaction, yes, and language and behavior have an interaction, but it doesn't mean that, like, Eskimos are thinking very detailed, snowy thoughts all the time.
Right.
Having said that, one of the things we do like to do is think about how the users have addressed something and align with them. So you need to think about how the interaction works for your particular participant in the conversation. And then also there's these higher level issues. So one of the examples I was thinking of is, like, if I were to say, hey, what's on my calendar this morning to the Google Assistant, we have had to think hard about the fact that I needed to set up the settings in my Google Home app such that the Google Assistant has access to my personal calendar, right? So there's whether I've allowed that in the first place. So, I mean, if we wanted to just ride roughshod over and go like, oh, they asked for their calendar, we'll give them their calendar.
Let me look at that Gmail address.
Yeah, let me look that up. Like, we technically could probably do that, but that's against all of Google's principles, right? We want users to be in control. So we have all these settings for controls so that voice interactions don't necessarily overstep bounds of appropriate social behaviors, right? So you definitely want to manage that. And we have whole big groups about security and privacy as well to protect people's data and to you know, in a sense, protect people from themselves sometimes. Like, I've got my doctor's appointment for that really nasty rash. I don't want that necessarily showing up on my shared home.
When you ask your assistant, what's on the calendar for that day, and starts telling everybody, you got that doctor appointment.
Yes. We make it clear to users that, hey, this is a shared device. Are you sure you want to have this there? So there's a lot of consideration around that kind of management of people's own lives and data. Like, we want to make it easy for them to get as much detail as they want. We want them also to understand what the ramifications of those choices of settings are.
The number of times that Margaret and I individually have written prompts or small dialogues about, sure, I can do that for you, but first I'll need you to link your account in the Google Home app. Time if we enumerated all of those. So yeah, we take privacy and security and we take that very seriously, and we're constantly getting updates about, you know, oh, this is how we should be solving this problem over here. This is how, this is this new design consideration that we should be considering. And I mean, it's very much in the forefront of our thoughts.
And testing with users to make sure or to determine what their level of understanding is, because one of the things that I think is a little too easy to do is giving so much choice in options and settings and things that it becomes a lot of noise and not a lot of signal. So you need to, again, it's Gricean relevance. Like, what do you present at the right time so that people understand the context and are able to work with it?
It's also when you're talking to someone who knows a lot about you, they kind of weigh what is creepy and not creepy to mention in that moment. That's a very human thing to do. So the assistant, we try and make sure that it doesn't kind of pass that line of, well, I know a lot about you, so here's all the things that I know about you.
My sister and I were standing at a public bus stop. She wouldn't be like, hey, how'd it go with that nasty rash?
So it's the role of the assistant to be your trusted partner in a lot of these things. Yeah. And that's very much how we think about it.
Yeah.
Cool.
It's an elevation of the idea.
Awesome. So I think we're about out of time. So we're going to jump into what we call the lightning round.
Okay. So the first one is, how does your team do design reviews?
So as we spoke about, we do crits. We will share designs with senior designers, with other designers, with cross-functional designers, in addition to
it's
product.
Informal and it's formal, and it's at every level of fidelity, right? To test both internally and externally, and to understand how the designs work. So there's, I mean, and it can get down and dirty, right? Sometimes people will utterly disagree, and so you need to kind of present a case for why a design should be done a particular way, or just reach a decision about it.
That's why, as we had mentioned earlier, it's really important to be able to talk about your designs, the reason that you've done something, not just having an intuition around it. It's okay to start with an intuition, but you should try and put that into words later.
Excellent. What are two or three qualities you look for in a conversation designer?
Margaret?
Well, yeah, that is that sensitivity to language, but it's also, I go back as well to, so it's something that, ooh, what an incoherent sentence start, thinking about language. Linguistics, one of the things I noticed, you know, they give you these data sets and then you have to abstract out what the roots are and what the changes are and what are the phonological contexts that drive those changes, right? So you sort of find out what the base is and find out what the changes are. And I used to think of that abstraction as a linguistics thing, but then what I've discovered is it really is about abstracting principles out of data. And yeah, it doesn't have to be linguistics. It could be cognitive science. It could be psychology. It could be sociology. It can come from all these. It's critical thinking and it's abstract thinking that is a massive benefit to doing design.
Yeah, I agree.
Awesome.
So there's layers to a craft, just to preface this question. You know, there's people that are really good at doing software, like really good at Sketch, and they're really good production designers. But what we're trying to figure out in this question is how the best designers are the ones that aren't constrained to a medium. What they're really good at is vetting ideas and having their own personal work style, like their own voice. So like Michael, like you, like only you can do the kind of work you do. Like you get to a point in your career where people hire you just because of like your personal work style, and we like to call that like your voice, like finding your voice. How do you find your voice in design? I mean, no pun intended with the topic of this interview, but yeah, like how do you find your voice as a designer? How do you not become a commodity designer? How do you find your voice in design? Like how do you how do you like find your own personal work style that people hire you for?
It's, you know, that's an interesting question because there's so for instance, when I worked as an editor for a publishing house, what we had was called house style, right? So just because I came from a background where I spelled a word dialogue with a UE on the end, it doesn't matter. Google spells it with no UE. Like the way we spell dialogue here is D-I-A-L-O-G. And that house style translates into other ideas. For instance, the persona of the assistant. So I wouldn't write like, hey, I'll do my own crazy thing for the assistant because that's expressing my personal creativity. The way I think of my voice is applying the depth of knowledge that I have about language and learning how to translate the knowledge about language into the best prompt. So it's application of skills as opposed to expression of individual creativity.
Yeah, I agree with that. So I guess to restate the prompt, essentially, how did I find my voice in design? I think having a curiosity about language and combining that with kind of a joy of problem solving and taking on hard problems and wanting to find creative solutions. That's kind of the underpinnings of my voice in design. And then practically how that manifests is I think that I'm very, very good at working cross-functionally with engineers and with product. And that's definitely something that you have to practice. But what ends up happening is I'm given assignments frequently that are engineering very difficult to accomplish, or from a product perspective are kind of murky. And what's needed is a designer who is able to kind of bridge the communication space. So while I haven't been doing conversation design or UX for a very long time, so I don't have this like decade of experience, what I do have is a really strong communication and communication ethic, I would say. And communicating to engineers the way that engineers need to be communicated to, working with product the way that product needs to be worked with, and then kind of me as the UXer trying to make sure that there's a glue and a synergy between us.
Amen.
Thank you.
Amen.
I concur.
Michael said the word joy, which is so perfectly apropos, right? There is this delight in creating something that you know is beautiful and is usable. And when you have that cross-functional communication that makes that happen, instead of the kind of push-pull of challenges and stuff falling between the cracks, it's such a beautiful moment.
It really is. It really, really is. And it's almost also when you have a long time of working with a team and there's struggle and strife a little bit, and it's all for good reasons. Like, everybody wants to make this the best that they can possibly make it. When you finally reach the point where everybody's kind of jiving at the same time, it's an incredible feeling.
Love it. So last questions here. We're almost out of time. This is for both of you. If you could go back in time, if you had a time machine, and it emphasis on the time machine, what you know now, what would you have done differently?
So, given that I was most recently out of college, I think when I think about this question, I think about what would I have done in college maybe a little bit differently that would have set me up better for this. I think I probably would have taken one or two more high level engineering classes, software engineering and computer science classes, not to learn how to be a computer scientist, but to learn about concepts in computer science. Mm. And this kind of lends itself to the notion that being a good designer doesn't mean being good only at designing. It's extremely cross-functional. It's extremely generalist. Being a good designer means that you can think about the problem from different perspectives. And that's the kind of thing that in university, oftentimes we get rat-holed into our discipline, take classes for your discipline. Don't worry about the other things. It's not going to be relevant for your career. As a designer, I completely disagree with that. I loved classes, my neuroscience classes, things that are completely unrelated to linguistics, frankly. And that, I think, has helped me very greatly as in beginning my design career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's a sense in which the thing that for years I felt guilty about the fact that I abandoned my PhD program to go and work at Nuance, like sliding sideways into industry, and not, you know, finishing the PhD like my sister, who has a linguistics. But being proud and strong as a generalist and learning parts of all these different disciplines is something I've always loved and I've always been glad I did. And to turn around and say, hey, you know, it's fine not to have a PhD in linguistics because I'm doing something that I really love, especially in an environment with great people. So
being a specialist is very impressive. And I have an old friend who's been a professor for a very long time. And he says, it's really hard to find true generalists anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a large concentration of generalists in design, in UX.
Yeah. And just also in the history of science and philosophy, you had these polymaths whose experience in all these different domains gave them the mental scope to come up with these great ideas and wonderful inventions. I mean, I'm not claiming I'm Leonardo da Vinci, but, you know.
Just, I'm actually in the last three chapters of this biography by that's on Leonardo da Vinci. So, perfect point.
So what you're saying is that, you know, if you want to do good in product design, it's doing what excites you, and you both seem like that type of person that just sees the gestalt, like sees how everything connects, and that's what makes this job so exciting.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Well, is there anything you guys want to plug? I mean, any feature launches, any selfish?
I mean, I would say for people who are interested in this, either from a practical perspective, not necessarily just conceptually, but they want some tools, our conversation design site, Google site, is really an incredible, incredible resource. What you guys see is pretty much what we see as well on the inside. If we ever have a question like, how should I word this? Or
we go back.
I have a problem. I don't know how to solve this quite. We go to that site. It really is kind of our central repository. I don't want to use Bible, but that's where information lives.
And just as a reference as well, our head of conversation design outreach is Kathy Pearl, the author of Designing Voice User Interfaces from O'Reilly.
Which was the first book on VUI that I read.
Oh, right. Okay.
And that was our second lunch, talking about this book that you were like, you should read this. And then I read it in days.
Yeah.
I was like, I gotta read it.
So I was going to say, Kathy Pearl, great to follow on Twitter because she's always finding these super links to interesting voice-related stuff as well, and pointing things out that you might not have noticed otherwise. Yep. So, yeah, she's a great person to follow on Twitter.
Yep.
Awesome. Well, Margaret and Michael, thank you so much for meeting with us. We love learning from you and gaining insights from your knowledge and experience.
You're so welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for taking the time. We're really excited to see what Google Conversational, like Google Assistant, like how that's going to go in the next few years.
Yeah, us as well, definitely.
we'll think about you guys whenever we use it.
Awesome.
All right, cool. Well,
Thanks, Ken.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to this episode.
Until next time.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening to The Way of Product Design. One quick favor, if you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your network, your friends, and hit that subscribe button on the show wherever you're listening to it. Thanks again for listening to the show, and I'm really excited to bring more awesome interviews and content your way. So keep listening, you won't be disappointed.